Good afternoon. Is it time? Sunny's time? Buenas tardes. Buenas tardes, jóvenes. You should all say, ooh, cool. You made me young again. It's a real pleasure to introduce our next speaker. It's somebody that I worked with for, 4 years or something? I don't know. We worked together for a long time at Missouri State University. When I left, I had stolen Pat from the chancellor, and she was my assistant dean and worked on project and program development. She is now at Mid-Nazarene University. What's your title there, Pat? Director of Institutional Effectiveness. And what institution wouldn't want to be effective, right, Jerry? Jerry's on the board, so he's, yeah. Anyway, Pat is a dear friend, and we worked on this together. We fashion designed it for Missouri State University. We pulled from a similar program that I ran at University of Mount Olive, North Carolina, and it's called the GOAL program. This has application for adult learners. When we went out to Tehachapi, and where is Tehachapi? That's what I thought. Yeah, I know where it is. I'm being facetious. I know Sylvia's here. Yo, Sylvia. I guess it's all that food that I ate is making me crazy. But when we had the meeting with Tehachapi and the other surrounding 4 chapter houses, they all voted unanimously for UNM Gallup to be present up there. But we realized when we didn't get the best collaboration we wanted from the local high school that it was adult learners who are asking for our help. So the whole point that we're thinking is we have to go back and rethink that and do a goalpost at Tehachapi as well as at Zuni, Virginia, and here on our campus and other points, abroad from our area. So I'll finish there. We have here Pat Walsh, and she's going to over the GOAL program for us. Pat?
Need to lower this a bit. It is a privilege for me to be here today with you. This is really I've driven through New Mexico before, but I've never stopped. And I'm glad I have. This is a beautiful place. I enjoyed the drive from Albuquerque yesterday with Dr. Dyer, and I was snapping pictures all the way here and all those beautiful storm clouds popping up everywhere. I know you guys don't seem to like the rain, but it's kind of normal where I come from in Kansas. But it was beautiful, and I am very appreciative to be here with you today, and I want to thank Mr. Lovett for including me in your schedule. Melissa and Era and Christy, you've been great to work with, and especially Dr. Dyer for inviting me to come and share with you today. He and I, as he said, worked at Missouri State West Plains for several years. I was at Mid-American Nazarene. It's a school that's a small private institution that's located just outside Kansas City. And I worked there for 26 years, and I left and went to Missouri State West Plains for 5, and I'm now back at Mid-American Nazarene. My years at West Plains were very valuable and useful in my learning more and more about higher education. I had always worked at a private institution, so that was a public institution, and I learned a lot there. One of the things that I got to do, as Dr. Dyer said, was he saved me out of the chancellor's office, and I got to go back into academics, which I really missed. And he and I worked on projects together, but if you've worked with Dr. Dyer at all, you know he's a big idea person. He's always has ideas and ways to deal with problems and issues. And one of the things in that area that we faced was college education for adults and how to make it accessible to our adults in our community who needed a college education. Educational attainment levels for adults was not very high, and we needed to have programs available for them. And so the GOAL program was developed in order to give another way for an adult to get a degree. And so I'm going to talk to you about today about that that GOAL program. GOAL stands for Great Opportunities for Adult Learners. And I'm going to take each one of those words, and we're going to build a framework for what the GOAL program is by using each one of those words, although we're not taking them in order. We're going to do kind of an anagram kind of thing with it. But we're going to use each of those words to build a framework for what this GOAL program looks like for your adult students. So we're going to take the word adult first and look at what does it mean for adults in higher education. Just a brief history of how these innovative programs for adults were developed. In the mid 20th century, several academics got their heads together and became interested in how to take higher education and adapt it to adult learning theories that were being developed at the time. Dr. Knowles was one of the main people to be involved with this, developing theories of adult learner needs. A professor at UC Berkeley took his theories and started to create programs that were designed specifically for adult learners in higher education. And then Sperling established the University of Phoenix as a way for private schools to market and recruit and develop curriculum for adults. This work continued on and developed in the 80s to where it was mostly small private universities across the country started to develop these adult programs that were designed to meet the needs of the adults in their community who had been to college but never completed a degree. And so this became a way for adults to complete a college degree. I myself went through a similar program at my university, Mid-America. I had started working there, but I did not have a college degree. I'd been to a community college. I went right out of high school to college, but then I got married and had a family, started working, things crowded in, and I never did finish that degree. And so my university, Mid-America, developed a program for adults to come back and complete a degree, and that's what I did. That's how I earned my bachelor's degree, was through an adult education program that was designed specifically for adults, one of these programs that was formed on these adult learning theories. I also did my master's of business administration in a similar adult cohort-based accelerated degree completion program. And so that's what we're going to talk about, is that kind of a program for your adults. So innovation in adult education, it looks like this. It's convenient. It's in a location that's convenient. It's a dependable course schedule. It's not just, here's our catalog of classes, what do you want to take? That's not what it is. It's a dependable schedule that adults know when the classes are going to be. It's a cohort model. Adults are put in a cohort and they go through the program together, taking the same classes at the same time. There's collaborative learning. It's not just lecture. It's collaborative learning, group projects, developing communication skills. It's helping adults learn how to make practical application of what they're learning in the classroom to their work life and their personal life. Here's a few statistics. Here at the UNM Gallup campus, you are already serving adult students. Your latest available IPEDS data shows that about 40% of your students are adults 25 years and over. So you're already serving this population, and hopefully GOAL can give you another tool that you have in your programming to meet the needs of these students and help them complete their degrees. Also in McKinley County, the educational attainment levels of adults that are 25 years of age and older, 33% of them have gone to high school, and that's as far as they've gone. 22% more have some college but have never finished a degree. So that's a huge population for you to work with, and hopefully the GOAL program, like I said, can help you meet the needs of some of these students. So the next piece that we're going to look at is opportunity, the word opportunity from goal. Your mission here at the University Gallup is to prepare people to achieve their educational professional goals. Goal program can help fulfill that. It can be one, like I said, one more thing that you have to offer your students in a way that, to help them complete their educational goals. In the strategic plan for the university, your strategic direction number one is excellence and innovation. And from that strategic direction, there's several items in there where the goal program just fits perfectly. You want to foster higher retention, academic progress, and completion. This is a way to do that for adult learners. You want programs to be academically excellent and viable, serve the needs of your students. You want to focus and define clear programs and pathways allowing students to continue on to bachelor's degree. You can do that with the GOAL program. The GOAL program can provide access and success. It provides access to adult learners in a modality that is cohort-based for adults age 25 and older. It's structured. It's a guided pathway through the curriculum. It's accelerated, 8-week classes. It's convenient, 2 nights a week. And they can complete their degree. You give them a pathway that is structured and they know how they're going to get there. Excuse me. They also can be eligible for financial aid and be considered full-time students with the way the program is constructed. All of these factors will help them not just give them access to education, but will help them be successful and complete their degree, attain their goal. So the learners, let's talk about the learners and what this piece of the framework looks like. This target population, I've alluded to it already. It's adults, working adults, family responsibilities. They can't quit work. They can't quit their families. They can't quit all of that to come to you during the day and take classes in your traditional course offerings. They need something different than that. They have difficult schedules that they have to work around. They can't take time off to take those traditional courses. This is your target population with this program. They need a predictable schedule that will turn them, the end result will be a degree. It gives them a clear path, like I've said. So the curriculum that Dr. Dyer said you would want to use in your GOAL program, at least for this initial implementation of it, is your Associate of Arts degree. So you already have that curriculum in place. You already have the courses that are already identified. It's just a matter of restructuring them into this accelerated cohort-based model. One of the things we learned at West Plains, we had several of the students towards the end of the program we did the Associate of Arts degree, and they wanted to know if they could take a class in entrepreneurship or agriculture was a big program and a needed thing in that area. And we had to tell them, well, no, the GOAL program is these courses. If you want to take those courses, you're welcome to, but it's on top of what you're doing in the GOAL program. So something you might consider as you're structuring this program is seeing if there's maybe 2 or 3 courses from some of your popular areas, business, entrepreneurship, healthcare, those kinds of things that you could include in the program as part of the curriculum. The structure, again, is 8-week sessions with 2 classes per session, 2 nights a week, 3 to 4 hours each night. And then it takes about 5 semesters, 2 of those 8 weeks per semester to get through the program. A clear goal, a clear guided path through, and it's set for the adults. They don't have to think about, well, what classes am I going to take this semester? They already know. It's already set for them. One of the things that you need to consider is your credit hour policy. In the catalog for UNM Gallup, the credit hour policy says most academic courses meet 150 minutes a week for 16 weeks and earn 3 credit hours per semester. That turns out to be about 40 hours of instructional time for a student to earn 3 credits. That having to have that kind of a policy and the implementation of that policy is a part of the U.S. Department of Education's guidance about financial aid. They're measuring seat time, and so they need to make sure that the financial aid a student is getting for that 3-credit-hour course, they're getting the instructional time that represents. And so you have to have every school in the country that's getting financial aid for their students has to have a credit hour policy that outlines what that is. And so for you here, it's a instructional time of 40 hours is 3 credit hours. Well, now we're talking about taking those same 3 credit hours and a student's going to earn those 3 credit hours in 8 weeks. So how are you going to do that? If your class is 3 hours a week for 8 weeks, that's about 24 hours of instructional time. Four hours a week for 8 weeks, that's about 32 hours of instructional time. So how do you fill the gap between the instructional seat time and your policy, what is actually taking place, and your policy? So what you have to do is you offer the courses in a hybrid mode where it's part in the class and part out of the class. And what you do is you offer instructional activities that are outside of the class. And this is different than homework. Homework is what the student has always done in a course. And that homework continues to be assigned. But the instructional activities are equivalent to what an instructor would have spent time doing in the classroom. So for instance, this just gives a sample list from a document we developed at my school that helps our programs that are accelerated to know how to, our faculty as they're developing their courses, know how to build instructional activities that occur outside the classroom. And I have a copy of this I'm going to share with Dr. Dyer that he will be able to use with the faculty in helping them develop instructional activities. But for instance, an instructor you're in class, an instructor gives you a reading assignment. That's your homework, to read the assignment. You come to class, and the instructor has a discussion with the class over that reading assignment. The students interact. The students give input into that discussion. The instructor interjects comments into the discussion, and the discussion takes place. So to take that instructional activity of that discussion outside the classroom, you're still going to make that reading assignment, and that's still going to be homework. But you're going to have a discussion board in your learning management system on that reading assignment. And it's going to be directed by the instructor. The students are going to be probably given a question to respond to from that reading assignment. And the students will respond, and the instructor responds. And so the time doing that represents this instructional activity that would have happened in the classroom. And so that's how you build a hybrid program with equivalent instructional activities that occur outside the classroom in addition to the seat time that's occurring in the classroom. And that means that you can still qualify for aid for that 3-credit hour course. So that's an important piece of financial aid. I don't like that financial aid drives those kind of things, but it does kind of make you responsible to ensure that the same learning is occurring that you would have had in that 16-week seated course. So I've taken you through the adults and learners and opportunity and those pieces of the framework that it takes to do this program. So what's it going to take for this to be a great program for University of New Mexico Gallup campus? That's what we're going to talk about next. We're going to try to fill this out a little bit, this basic structure I've given you, and talk about different things that UNM Gallup needs to do to take this program and make it great for you and your adult learners. So some of the things you need to think about: student services that are designed for adult students who are on campus exclusively in the evening. So financial aid counseling, They need financial aid counseling just like every other student. And maybe they can run up to campus on their lunch hour, but maybe not. So you need to figure out how you're going to handle that for these adult students. Enrollment services, since this is a lockstep program that all these students are doing, maybe they don't need to do registration themselves. Maybe your registrar's office will process the registration for them. They need advising. They need advocacy. The students do. They need someone they know they can go to if there's an issue, and know that that person will be there to take care of those things for them. Is your library does your library operate with hours sufficient to meet the needs of these students? Are your computer labs available to students who are here exclusively in the evening? Others that you may think of, IT support. If teachers are using IT in their technology, in their courses, and something goes wrong, which it always will, do you have IT support for those instructors that are teaching in the evening? So those are the kinds of things that you need to think of to really make this program work and not have issues. Also, you need your faculty committed to doing this. They already have the courses. They've been teaching the courses. But they need to be committed to taking those courses and adapting them to the accelerated format and this hybrid format to offer to students. They need to be able to have appropriate those instructional activities that are appropriate for their courses. One of the things that they need to make sure, this English comp class that's offered over here in 16 weeks needs to have the same learning outcomes that this 8-week accelerated course has to have. So they need to make sure that maybe they're not using the same assessments, but they need to make sure that the outcomes are going to be the same. You might consider pairing courses. At West Plains, we paired a creative writing course with a history class, and they shared assignments. So that's something that you can do to make this a successful program. You need to have collaborative, team-based activities, and you need to consider the skills and experiences that adults bring. They are powerful learners. I'm going to share with you a quote from one of the instructors. He was an English comp instructor from West Plains who worked with the GOAL program and worked with our GOAL program students. And this is what he said. He said, "I am happy to report that thus far the quality of the students in this program has exceeded my expectations." He was comparing them with his traditional students. He said, "Generally their writing is better, their discussion is clearer, and their effort is stronger." And I think adults do have a different kind of commitment when they come to college than your typical 18-year-old. And so you need to consider what they're bringing to the classroom as well as what you're bringing as an instructor or the institution. Other issues to consider, we had some students who wanted to do the GOAL program. They were not quite college ready. Remember, these are people that have been, it's 5, 10, 15 years since they've sat in a classroom, since they've been in an algebra class, or since they've written an essay. And so you need to think about how you're going to help those students be ready for this program, because they don't do developmental education while they're in this program. They need to be prepared to walk into the classroom and be successful. You don't want to set them up for failure. So you might consider partnering with your adult basic education people and seeing what you can come up with as a skill development or skill brush-up kind of program for students that need that. Not all of them will need it, but some will. You're going to need attendance policies. An 8-week accelerated missing one night is like missing 1 week in a 16-week session. So you need to have appropriate attendance policies. How are the students going to make up that work? There'll be students that, remember that 22% that had some college but no degree? They're going to come with some classes already, and maybe those classes are duplicated in the GOAL program. How are you going? You need to have a policy to deal with that, because maybe you want to let them have up to a certain number of classes or credits that they can use from their prior experience towards the program. But remember, one of the main structure in this program is that cohort. And that cohort is a powerful thing, so you don't want to do a whole lot to distract from that. And you want, hopefully you can take this program and build some bridges to for students that want to go on and complete a bachelor's degree. So many students in the West Plains program went on to complete bachelor's degrees. One last thing. So you've got this program started at UNM Gallup campus. Now what? You've got your first first cohort going. The courses are in place. How are you going to grow the program? Because the cohort, 20 to 25 students is the max for that. So you're not going to admit 100 students to this program when you first start it. So it's not going to be, numbers-wise, a huge significant thing. So how are you going to grow it? There's a couple different ways that you're going to be able to do that. You're going to start new cohorts, right? So your first eight-week session is over with, or maybe your first two are over with, and you start a new cohort. You start over again with that new cohort. You're going to do it in different locations, as Dr. Dyer mentioned when he was introducing me. That's another way to grow the program. Another way to grow this is to take some of your other degrees besides your Associate of Arts degree and take those courses and develop them into these eight-week sessions and offer some of your other associate degrees this way. So that's how you're going to grow the program. That's goal, great opportunities for adult learners. Hopefully, I've shared something with you that you can take away from this, and I hope that this becomes a strong program here at UNM Gallup. I think with Dr. Dyer's leadership, it can be. Any questions? Yes, Dr. Dyer.
So then why would we present this at a conference on workforce development?
You tell me, because you put me here.
I thought you never asked me. You're a full-time employee and you're a full-time parent. Let's say that your job, in your job, you want to be able to progress. Or let's say your supervisor would like you to have a better skill set and more knowledge and get a college degree. How are you going to do that? You're working from 8 to 5 or 9 to 5. You know, you have other responsibilities. This is how you do that.
So that's how I did it. I knew I could do more than what I was doing without a degree. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I did it.
And so imagine that, growing our workforce this way.
Is there any room in the program for work-life experience being given as credit hours for that
group? On the associate's level, I don't think that's a good place for it. I think that can be used to bridge the gap between what's needed in a bachelor's program once they complete this associate's degree. Now, there could be others that think differently than that, but that's how I see prior learning experience credit. We have a huge prior learning credit experience program at MidAmerica, and it's used for students to bridge the gap between general education, all the hours they had to do, that's basically an associate's degree, and what they need to do in the major to complete a bachelor's degree. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I had an experience that leads to being very careful about that concept. Okay, it's old experience, back in the 70s, but the community college that I applied to, they said, oh, you were in the Navy, you were a fire control technician. We'll give you credit for Physics 101. Sounded great to me. Except the problem was their Physics 101 flowed into their Physics, I guess, 102, I don't remember. Point being, they had a particular flow in mind for those.
Sure.
And my experience did not mesh very well with their flow, and I struggled with it.
You're absolutely right. You need to be with prior learning experience credit, you need to be careful that it's, if it's going to be used for a prerequisite for something like that, that student really does have the skills to do that. Most the prior learning assessment that we do is based on the American Council of Education and their assessment of the training in the military and business and that kind of thing. So there's standards there that have been set up, but you're exactly right.
Are you all familiar with IBEST? This is a program you take remedial education and you embed it with a topical component course so you can then get college credit for it. But one of the thoughts that I had when we went over this, when I reviewed Pat's slides, is we can take those things that we talked about this morning until in terms of skill development and apprenticeship activities, and those can be part of that gap of 8 credit, 8 C hours that then are imbued, and we can even work with employers what would you want that to look like for basic reading or writing? And we talked about, and Robert was talking about the housing issues and how people needed those skills. So those are the other things that you can add in, which are experiential and will give added value, I think, to having this degree. And so imagine then all of his employees, and of course, where's Robert? Anyway, is he still here? Can't see him. He's not here. So, well, this is a good thing then. So imagine Robert paying for all the tuition for all his employees to get their associates. Wouldn't that be magnanimous of him? Shall we report to him that he's going to do that and issue an inspection? No, but in fact, that was done by some employees in West Plains. One of the banks, actually.
They had a tuition assistance program, and they helped their employees go through the program.
So let's challenge our banks. Have a tuition assistance program for those employees who don't have degrees, and they can get trained up. Same thing for Navajo Nation. Where's Ron? He left too. Oh, good. Perfect. Oh, God. But you agree with that, don't you, Ron?
Yes,
there you go. So there are some ways to do this. What about the program in resilience? Is that what it's called? Ron? There's a program in Navajo Nation about individual resilience what's that called, Meryl? Self-reliance, excuse me. And this would work for that, too. And now, when we talked about, we mentioned the chapter houses at the beginning, right? And there, and our population is spread. If we're using Zoom technology networks, and then we have local instructors. The great thing about this program is you can do it where you are. So it's for the people where you are. And that's one of the strengths of it. So this could be done in Alamogordo. It could be done in Raton. It can be done in Albuquerque. It can be done in Crown Point. And you're not competing with each other. You can share classes even. Maybe someone has a geography class over in Grants and we have a professor there, but we don't have one here. Can we integrate that course into GOAL? Yeah, they take it as an online course or a hybrid course with a Zoom technology link. And now that's part of our curriculum and their instructors pay for it. And we can do the same for them if they want to set up their GOAL program. So I see this as something we could do in the whole state, but we certainly want to pilot it here. Any more questions? Yes.
It's not a question, but I just wanted to mention that I went through a similar program through the University of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. And did it work for you?
Yes.
I know you're educated. I've seen your education. So Zuni's going to be one of our goalposts, right? Goalposts for you people who like football. Hopefully there aren't any Denver Bronco fans in here, are there?
Yes, sir.
Never mind. We won't have one in Denver.
No, okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good discussion. Thank you. Those fajitas just now settling in, huh? I think we need that yoga. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Where's all my help? They take a siesta? ¿Dónde está? Did Leonard say he was going to be back? Okay, so we'll go ahead and move on. I want to introduce now the first speaker for this afternoon on this, The theme is the challenges of workforce development, economic development in Native communities. Our first speaker will be the Councilwoman Puebla of Zuni, and I'll have her introduce herself, Virginia Chavez.
Good afternoon. Okay, good afternoon. Happy to be here and be a part of this. This is going really great, learning a lot, and look forward to collaboration in the future regarding the outcome of this. So thank you again. Again, my name is Virginia Chavez. I'm on the Zuni Tribal Council. This is my first term being on the council. We're in our second year of a four-year term, so thank you. Zuni has its own share of high unemployment, poverty, and no jobs in the community. So we do share in the challenges that we face regarding our workforce and our economic development. There are three major employment sectors in our Zuni Pueblo, and they are the tribal government, the hospital, and the Zuni Public School District. According to the U.S. Census Survey, the unemployment rate for Zuni is at 76%. But this may be somewhat misleading because many of our Zuni people are self-employed who make jewelry, pottery, fetishes, paintings, and beadwork. Jewelry making and artwork are either primary or supplemental sources of income for many of our Zuni people. Also, many of our Zuni people commute to Gallup or elsewhere for employment. Arts and crafts production is the largest source of income for our Zuni Pueblo, for our Zuni people, who are not otherwise employed within the government sector or elsewhere. About 50% of those over the age of 16 are employed in Zuni, according to the UNM Bureau of Business and Economic Research report, commonly known as the Bieber Report, and that a majority of those employed in Zuni are women. Our Zuni artisans sell their products in Zuni, Gallup, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and in Arizona. The challenges that these artisans face is the difficulty in finding buyers, especially during the winter months when business is low, so they have to travel elsewhere to sell their products. However, traveling takes time and is costly. So the traveling takes away from their families and also from making more jewelry or their artwork. When business is slow, the Zuni artisans usually end up selling their products at a reduced price, which hurts not only theirs but other artisans' fair market prices. Another challenge the artisans face is marketing. Many of our artisans do not have internet connectivity in their homes, so this prohibits them from promoting their jewelry or artwork to outsiders or prospective buyers. Zuni Pueblo is rich in culture and is known for its exquisite jewelry, pottery, fetishes, paintings, and beadwork. So we need to expand on these talents and skills and build upon our culture and our people's skills. A lot of our Zuni people may not have college degrees, but they are very skilled and creative in their artwork. I am amazed at what our people can create just by working with their hands. I have seen a lot of beautiful work and truly impressed with what they can create. So we need to help these artisans market their work by providing classes or training in marketing, website development, customer relations, business development, investments, retirement planning, financial management, income tax consulting, and native arts laws and protection. Another cultural strength that we have in Zuni that we can build upon is cultural-based tourism. We can do this by showcasing our artisans at work, making their products, and they can also view women, Zuni women cook traditional foods, provide tours around our community, view social dances, and listen to traditional storytelling. By doing all these, tourists can stay in Zuni more than one day and stay at our very own bed and breakfast that we have in Zuni, or they can stay here in Gallup. This will help both community economy. This will help both of our economies in our communities. Must be the food or something. I can't talk. I don't know. By keeping the tourists in our village, we can even pay for our very own India market that we can have right in our village, or even our own Zuni show where we can showcase and sell our artisans' exquisite artwork. We also have some farming and agriculture in our community, and we would like to expand on this important traditional and cultural strength. It would be great to create corporations that will sell the products, the produce from our community farming projects to the outside world, but we do not have an abundant supply of water, so this prohibits and this limits our prospects in this worthwhile venture. But it's something that we really would like to do, you know, farming into promote farming and agriculture. Another topic, important topic that we would like to focus on is entrepreneurship, as was mentioned this morning. We need to help our local people who are interested in starting their own businesses but don't know quite how to do it. Therefore, we need to have more classes and trainings in entrepreneurship, business development, website development, and marketing to help these people establish their own business and to be successful in their business. Our banks can also help them by providing loans to start their own businesses. Since a large number of our workforce is within the government sector, we cannot forget about these employees. We need to help our current workforce by providing classes to help enhance their job skills through continuing education and trainings. We need to help our people who are currently employed in tribal programs, the hospital, our school district, and tribal leadership. Therefore, classes and trainings are needed in the areas of ethics, team building, how to treat your employees, how to work with your supervisor, effective workplace communication, boosting employee morale, conflict resolution, creating a good resume, law enforcement, EMT certification, information technology, tribal leadership, tribal governance, tribal law, women in leadership, teacher trainings, classroom management, and the list goes on and on. I know we have a good nursing program here at UNM Gallup, but we do have a shortage of nurses in our local hospital, so we need to entice more people to go into the nursing field. UNM Gallup used to have a good radiology technician program in the past, so I don't know if that program has been brought back or if it hasn't yet. I think it should be restarted, but that was a good program. It would also be beneficial to bring more classes in the medical field so our students do not have to travel far, and then rather they can stay here and get their education or their specialized training in these fields. We currently have various construction projects going on in our community. We just finished our new elementary school, and then the Zuni Christian School is still in progress. Through these construction progress that we've had now and in the past in our pueblo, we have learned that there is a need for journeyman licenses in the areas of plumbing, carpentry, electrical, and HVAC systems. There's also a need for OSHA training for CDL drivers and operators. All these degrees and specialized training programs would benefit and help develop our workforce in our economy. Education and specialized trainings in all these areas of workforce development are important factors in helping our economy grow. So we need to emphasize on the importance of education to our children and youth, as was mentioned this morning as well. As you may be aware, and I know Dr. Dyer is a main player in this as well, the Zuni tribe took over the college in Zuni. And we are enthusiastic about taking over our college and it to be a great source in serving the needs of our community. So I know, as I mentioned, all these courses that we would like for our community, we like to implement those and help serve our community in the areas where they need it most. And by being responsive to our local needs, we can also help our economy. We need to use our social economics as a strategy to improve our communities. However, in order to help our community and our economy, we need to address the social problems that we face in our communities, such as alcoholism and drug and substance abuse. Education is the key in addressing these issues. I feel that we need to educate our people about the dangers of alcohol and drug abuse and how it is harming and destroying our brains and our bodies. I know Gallup Independent published a full-page article, or not an article, but a poster, and I clipped it out, and I would like to see more of that, and I brought it with me. This was published last year. I don't know if you remember seeing this, but it's a picture of a poster child, and it's regarding tobacco use. And I think we need to do something like this so that we can educate our community about the dangers of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, you know, substance abuse. But this one, it has a picture of a girl and how smoking affects their brains and their bodies, where they can get addicted. Smoking can cause wrinkles, can cause cataracts, can cause mouth cancers, skin damage, throat cancer, psoriasis, heart disease, lung disease, and stomach ulcers. And it has pictures of what the damage can do to your body and your organs. So I think we need to do something more like this so that we can educate our community about the dangers of drug abuse and alcohol abuse. I think it would be great if we could, not only maybe here in Gallup and in all our communities, even maybe along the highway, if we could have billboards, something like this, so that this can open up the eyes of our people, especially our youth, so that they won't go into alcoholism or drug abuse. And even to our adults who may already be in alcohol, you know, maybe into alcohol, that, you know, some kind of something like this where you know, they can actually see the pictures. I think this will actually open up their eyes so that they can, you know, stop their dependency on drugs and alcohol. So I believe this will actually help curtail the problem that we have in our communities. I know employment and having a career helps boost morale and builds upon an individual's self-esteem. The only way we can have a job and a career now is to have that education, but as it was mentioned too, we need to emphasize on our workforce, you know, other vocational, educational trainings, any kind of specialized trainings to help our people pursue their passions. This will not only help our community grow, but it will also help our economy grow as well. So we need to instill in our children and in our youth the importance of staying in school and getting an education or going into vocational training. Our children also need the love and encouragement to help boost their self-esteem so that they can grow up to be self-sufficient citizens of our society. And I just want to thank Dr. Dyer and the UNM staff and everyone else involved in putting up this this worthwhile summit. I think this is excellent, and I thank you all for taking that participation, and all have that dream, desire to improve our community. So like it was said this morning, let's not work in silos. Let's work together to make our communities a better place for our people to live in. Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay.
And a comment. Okay. The first is a comment, and I really like the fact you brought up radiology. We've been in conversation across the road with Robert McKinley about developing a degree program or certificate program in medical equipment technology. We have an excellent program now in medical lab technology and other areas, and also our EMT Institute had its first graduation, Emergency Medical Services Institute had its first graduation, 12 students, so that's growing and I think very successful. But That gets to that question about radiology, because that would be one of the pieces of that degree, because they would be trained on all kinds of equipment, all the really expensive equipment that's just across the street. The other question I have, when you're coming from Albuquerque, there's a poster, a billboard for Zuni.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yes, I've seen it.
Now, if I was coming into Zuni, though, and say, I'm going to go straight to Zuni. Let's say I'm a German germist and I don't know where I'm going, but Zuni's that way, so I go to Zuni. I really want to experience Zuni. My question is, where am I going to stay? I know there's one place.
Mm-hmm. The bed and breakfast?
We need more.
Yes, exactly. And we do need.
I'm thinking maybe if we get our program going with Horton for structural insulated panels, we can build a Zuni-inspired hotel in Zuni with artisan input on its design that would be that kind of total immersion experience for tourists and guests to come visit the Pueblo, which would have a significant capacity and also to be used as a landing place when you're advertising such things as important ceremonial things where people could at least observe the event occurring. So that, to me, is a thought.
Great idea, yeah.
Where's the hotel? And so I think we need to talk to Bell Matea and say, maybe get to the port builders and say, you know, since we're looking at other things, maybe this is a possibility for the future for Zuni.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We are looking at various ways and how we can bring, you know, improve our community, bring tourists to our community, and improve our economy. So a lot of discussions, a lot of things that we need to consider. But, yes, we are working.
Well, Pat and I are going to be down there tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
So make sure you tell us where to go buy stuff.
Buy stuff? Sure. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Virginia has also been a member of our UNM board for many terms. And, if you want a good place to eat, there's a place in Zuni that serves excellent chicken. What's the name of that?
Halona's.
Yeah, fried chicken.
The only thing wrong with Halona chicken is it's too healthy. You can add salt. That's still kind of talking about when it's clean. So you need to add some little salt. A little bit of salt, and it's the best chicken in the world.
Very good. Thank you very much. Our next speaker, I just want to do a quick survey. How many of you know Councilman Leonard Soucy? Raise your hand. Very good. Very good. It's really a pleasure to have him to have him speak this afternoon. And you know, some of us keep up with the local politics here and on Navajo, and even Zuni, and it's very interesting. And and you know, there's quite a bit of development that's trying to happen on Navajo, and you just heard Virginia talk about challenges down in Zuni, and so. I think it's time that we hear from the legislative section of our tribal governments. And this individual has some very interesting viewpoints, always has a different perspective. And sometimes we get into this tunnel vision of things that have to do with our government. And so, but he always comes in and gives you a new light on things. And I thought he would make a good speaker for the conference here, or for the summit. He's been the senator for the state of New Mexico, 1993 to 2007. And after he decided to run for the council, and he was successful in doing that in 2007, I believe, joined the 21st Navajo Nation Council. Originally from White Horse Lake, New Mexico. That's over in the Chaco Canyon area. has obtained his BS degree in the University of New Mexico and his Juris Doctorate from the University of New Mexico. So he's a trained attorney. And so I'll have him tell you about himself. Mr. Soucy.
Yeah. Mr. Moore. Aroyat eranota. Ko khashin ada kebe da kehi do shedi tro khanenshle. Arona nist ez vasas china shine da shche. Na kede ne da shnal. Yat eto. My name is Leonard Soucy. I was actually in a committee meeting. And so I told them, I'll be back at 3. And then they told me, we'll probably vote your legislation down, and then we'll be long gone by the time you come back. But it's the chance you take. So I ran back to Window Rock, and then back again, and then I had to run back over there again. Ninjona, I don't thank you for allowing me an opportunity to speak at this conference. I don't know if I have President Begay's time too, because what usually happens in Window Rock is say, time, his 5 minutes is up. And then they have a computer that kind of just automatically shuts me off. But I find other ways to talk and other ways to make a point. And it is true that at times and often my thinking is different than other people's thinking. And so I like to look at things in a different way. I recall when I was a state senator asking our state investment officer, said, well, he was talking about all the revenues we're getting off these state lands. And his presentation conveniently started from 1912. And so he goes, well, we got billions of dollars in our trust fund. You know, we got all this money coming in. And I asked him, so where did all this money come from? He goes, state lands, of course. And he didn't get it. I said, well, let me ask you this then. Where did we get the state land before 1912? Oh, the U.S. government gave it to us. Okay, so where did the U.S. government get it from? And then finally he goes, Native people. I said, oh, they stole it from Native people. These are Aboriginal Indian lands where a big chunk of the trust fund that also goes to educational institution comes from. And so when he admitted that, all these IBM type executives were sitting there in blue suits and red tie. I turned to them and I said, then to the committee, I rest my case. He just admitted that all this money comes off Aboriginal Indian land. So when we talk about workforce and also about economic development, I think we need to keep in mind the history and why at times we feel that Indian tribes aren't making it, or why there are no jobs in Indian communities, or why Native tribes are not performing, and why at times, of course, we laugh at them. We mock them, thinking that, you know, they're below us, that they don't know what they're doing. And I think this kind of attitude is prevalent. And I think we need to resolve ourselves to say we need to re-examine history. We need to rethink things. And the fight, the economic development is actually a fight over resources. There's only so much that comes in and so many dollars. How do you grab that dollar? Who's going to be first in line? Who's going to outdo who? to get that dollar. And that's what we fight over almost day in, day out. And I'll give you some examples. In the water rights battle, a long time ago, you need water for economic development. And when the United States was coming into being, the idea is just to take it. And then not recognize the rights of Indian tribes to have water. And so finally, the Winters Doctrine was born through a North Dakota case. But ever since then, the current U.S. Supreme Court has been chopping away at water rights. The Navajo Nation, I'm a Navajo Nation Council delegate, and I participate in these discussions, and Navajo Nation sits in three states. We have been fighting the states for water almost the whole Navajo Nation life since 1922. We went to Arizona, and there were about hundreds of people, and there was just two or three Navajo representatives asking for water rights and said, let's resolve this. Every county stood up and said no. Every city stood up and said no. The state of Arizona stood up and said no. But we need water. I happened to be a state senator at the time that the Navajo water rights was being resolved in New Mexico. And I got a chance to participate in it. And I recall asking not only the Navajo representatives, but the state representatives, even the U.S. senators, that we need water for Chaco area. We can't develop in the Chaco Canyon area without water. We just can't. So we need to figure out a way to get water there. So the first map they drew, the water line went from Shiprock to Gallup. It went from Shiprock to Gallup. And that was per the instructions of Senator Pete Domenici. He said, I want water for Gallup. And he didn't say, I want water for Navajo and those poor Navajos in Chaco Canyon area. I want water for Gallup. For myself, I said, no, I want water for Chaco area. We need water to do development. So we could develop a workforce, we could work out there and bring quality of life to our people. So we fought and fought and fought for about 3-4 years. In the end, I managed to succeed in getting what's called a cutter lateral line on there. Even some of the Navajo representatives threatened me with my re-election because I was not supporting the Navajo Gallup water settlement because there was no get water for Chaco area. And in the end, we appreciate, of course, that they put that on. And people are happy now. And we have grand plans. We were even now asking Gallup McKinley School, we want a golf team for Tseyigui High School. And then they said, well, where's your golf course? Don't worry about that. We're going to build one. In 2019, Cutter Lateral will be connected to the San Juan River. And we will never be out of water in the Chaco area again. But that's 2019. It's still the future. In the meantime, we're still trying to do the economic development. But Gallup already has water out of the Twin Lakes area pumping it over here. And that's why you saw three big tanks up there. It's off Navajo. And then you see hotels popping up. After they built the water tanks, the hotels started popping up. And I think we need to look at those things to see if it is fair, you know, to deny economic development to Native communities and pretend that we are helping Natives. If we are really going to help Natives, we have to stand side by side with them. Even, and I would ask our non-native brothers and sisters to stand with us even against non-native adversaries. We have to do that. Otherwise, you will see the disadvantages in native communities continue as it is today. And that's what causes it. It's rooted in history. And we need to make amends. The other good example is the Bennett Freeze area. Some BIA commissioner just said, I'm getting tired of these Navajos and Hopis constantly feuding with each other. I'm going to draw a square and say there will be no more development. Bennett Freeze area. And so Navajos were not allowed to develop, even repair their roof. And so for more than 40 years, that particular part of our nation was put at an extreme disadvantage. So why blame them for not being educated? Why blame them for not doing calculus? When in the beginning, a BIA operative decided to put them at an extreme disadvantage. I recall sitting here at one time talking about the veterans and the little clinic that they do. And you had Navajos coming in from far away into here. And they had tears in their eyes. There's no water over there. There's no economic activity over there. So we'll build that structure in Gallup. And you Navajos in the Bennett Freeze area will drive all the way over here to get medical attention. And whereas somebody living along interstate or in Gallup will just walk to the clinic. And so we continue to put these population at a strong disadvantage. And then you look at the schools. Or Lake Pyle is another good subject of mine while I'm on economic development. Lake Pyle area is the only place I know of in the United States where the jurisdiction of the lake was put horizontal. Now, who's the Wahoo that did this? One of them was Stuart Udall. At that time, he used to hug Navajo leaders and say, I love you. But on this side, he was taking away their water. And so when they did the horizontal jurisdiction, they said that the jurisdiction of Navajo, even though it should have been, every other map you see in the United States is mid-channel, down the middle of the river. Everywhere. The only place where it is not is in Lake Pyle, and it was because of Navajo Nation. And so non-Navajos like Stuart Udall and others sat there in some room in Washington, D.C. and said, how do we take this away from Navajo? How do we prevent them from using water? How do we prevent them from claiming the water? Somebody said, ha-ha, let's do it horizontally. So if you look at the Glen Canyon Dam Act, it says that, at 3720, a few feet above when the dam is full, that'll be the jurisdiction line of Navajo. So Congress, in 1700s, 1800s, late 1700s, U.S. Supreme Court said that, yeah, Congress has plenary power to do whatever they want, even subjugate Native people. And so Congress has this power in its takings. But Congress supposedly has this power to do the jurisdictional boundary of Lake Pyle horizontal. So at 3720, where the dam is supposed to be full, but the dam will never be full because the Lake Pyle supervisor will see to it that the water never touches Navajo Nation. And so there's an area there where we don't touch about 50 feet that Lake Powell, the National Park Service, claims jurisdiction. And then they twisted Raymond Nakai's hand and said, sign this agreement. That, you know, sign it to say that it's not yours. You know, and that's the history. Lake Powell is a gold mine for tourism. And we can't even touch the water. We can't even do economic development. So our people are unemployed. We could have been doing tourism left and right in Lake Powell. We would have been using that water left and right. But when Grand Canyon Dam happened, you know, the atrocious, discriminatory effect of the law that was enacted. We're still fighting that. And so we spent a lot of time fighting these things. And then coming back, Linda McCracken Mesa in Utah, the federal government said, we got this land in Utah. You know, give us the land at Page. And this one's got rolling hills of grass and everything. And so they gave it, and then, I don't know, you know, I wasn't a delegate at that time. But Navajos and U.S. government got together and they worked that out, and McCracken Mesa was given in exchange for Page. We found out that what they gave us was the top. And there's a lot of oil under there, and they didn't give us the mineral rights. And so we can't do oil and gas development and economic development because they reserve that for themselves. And so now, when you look at this estate, the estate law trumps the surface right. So when an oil company wants to come in, tells the Navajo family to move. And says, because I have oil under there, I need to get to my oil. You move. I don't care about your hogan. And so, and that's what we fight today. The only answer for us is to try to buy them out. But the resources that we would have used for economic development is now going to buying oil companies out so they won't push Navajo families out of the way. And it's a constant fight against injustice, historical injustice. And that's why we're unable to move fast on economic development. Let's come back home to McKinley County. Yeah. 709. Executive Order 709. Navajos had Aboriginal areas up that way, big area. And Executive Order 709 was to recognize that. And then in the 1930s and 40s, what happened? The ranchers, the mining interests, and all of that went, 1 year later, went to Washington. And because they're buddies with the U.S. president and his representatives, they said, you cannot give that to Navajo. They never invited Navajo leaders to say, what do you think? And so then the following year, the U.S. president zaps the executive order and turns Eastern Agency into a checkerboarded mess that we live with today. And it takes up a lot of our energy and our resources just trying to correct that injustice and figuring out a way to consolidate Navajo Nation landholding so we could do economic development. It's so checkerboarded to where, you know, we have to deal with the state, the county, BLM, almost everybody. It's a constant struggle to try to do economic development. And so we are so much been put in at a disadvantage by these historical dealings that have occurred. And, you know, we do need to correct those things. And otherwise, Navajo Nation, Navajo people will remain at a disadvantage. And it's not their fault. And good, well-meaning people have to say, this is wrong. This was wrong. and we need to change things. NEPA is another good example. NEPA was passed without consultation. And they've regarded in the Indian land as federal land. And so any development we do requires a federal action, according to them. I've argued against that and said, no, it's not. The definition of federal land is different and does not necessarily include Indian land. But BIA says, ah, oh, that's just peon soci. You know, we think we're the BIA, we're the Federal Department of Interior, we think it covers Indian land. So everything that we do, power line extension, water line extension, road easement, highway, all goes for NEPA analysis. And it adds on 10 years to the development and quadruples the cost. In the meantime, we all know that native lands have become impoverished areas. They're rich in resources in many ways, but all these historical dealings have caused it to be an impoverished state. And it's wrong. So, the other day I heard that the state of Arizona declines to accept dual credit programs with Navajo Nation. And it's because of jurisdiction. The state of Arizona wants us to address all arbitration and any dispute resolution in a state court. Navajo Nation says no. Then Arizona says, well, we can't accept your dual credit program. So your children will not be allowed dual credit. And that's the thing that we battle, and even for the state of New Mexico, not wanting to accept dual credit. I don't know if it's still like that today, but I know when I was in Santa Fe, not accepting credits from Dinette College or from NTU. So the children are put at a disadvantage again. They went to school at NTU and Dinette College up to this level, and all of a sudden their credit hours are not recognized. And so they end up falling back. And so how do we do the workforce development when we're frustrating the very humans that we're trying to help by these crazy laws and attitudes? It only hurts our children. So, and then you look at the representation. And today it's present. All you have to do is listen to KGAK or KTNN. Divide and conquer. Divide and conquer mentality of our representatives. We fight for representation and have a chance at the ballot box. So we could vote in a candidate of our choice. But what do the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and others do? They fight us and say, all you need to do is recruit one Navajo over here to speak against another Navajo. And we will win this race. And that's what you hear on KGAK and KTNN. And many of our leaders have caused to lose their way. So they end up speaking against their own people. We've had some real good candidates this year. Young Navajo lady from Ayambatot. A go-getter, and then an old council delegate speaking against her on KGAK. You know, it's wrong. And I've told her that. But that's how, you know, because these are the leaders that make decision on double taxation and many other issues. And we want a chance. And yet, you know, when our young people want to go and hold an office, you know, the divide and conquer attitude. Our schools, state schools, elementary school, including Navajo schools, are failing us. And Secretary Jewell has admitted this in front of me. over at Owen, Sino, and Counselor area that I represent, we have a lot of oil and gas jobs. But every time I drive through there, I see all these vehicles coming in from Bloomfield on 550 with flaps flapping. Same thing for the mine plant over here. And it's all those non-Navajo workers coming in. They've taken over the jobs. And then at 4 o'clock, you see them all driving back out. Our children have not been schooled in the technical fields. And so they can't get the jobs. And I see them walking the streets, the highways. I pick them up to take them home. I give them money for lunch money or something. These are students that were just graduated a few days or a few years ago. And so our schools have failed us. And I think we need to look at that core problem to fix it. I think the traditional way of schooling doesn't work. We need to rethink this. We need to have not only Navajo kids or other Native kids to get them back into the workforce. Otherwise, we will continue. I saw homelessness up here. And that's the problem of homelessness. It's the school's fault. Had you taught those kids right and they had a job, they wouldn't be homeless. And so I ask all of us, you know, not only to think intellectually about today's presentation, but also to begin to hold hands again and say we need to march forward and help, you know, our children all around. So, and then I was over at Home Depot the other day, and I, at the beginning, when it first opened, we were all, you know, and I buy a lot of my lumber here, there. I like their return policy. They don't ask questions. And so, but I noticed, though, that the declining Navajo workforce there. I don't know if it's intentional. And I was talking with one of the workers there, and said he just came in from Oregon about a week ago, and he already has a job. And so, but there's a declining Native workforce at Home Depot now. Is the mentality to do away with Indian workers still here today? You know, and if it is, let's admit to it and let's ask our businesses to not think like that. That, you know, this is a community, over 40% of the population in Gallup is Native population. And we need to help. I remember hearing on the radio, I won't name the representative, but remember that when the excise tax was put on for water and the advertisement was, the city of Gallup residents vote for this, you're not going to pay for this. Because most of our tax is raised by Indian people coming into Gallup. They will pay the tax. So vote for it. Remember that advertisement? And so Navajo people, being a major buyer in Gallup, is now paying for the residents of Gallup, your water line, your water line contribution for the Navajo Gallup water line. So, you know, go figure. Those are the historical things. I think we need to, if we really want workforce development, economic development, we need to be fair to Native communities. But I just came from a protest march that Navajo school boards were having, and they want the head of the superintendent of school. And I just told him, it is also your fault. And we need to do better for schools. And I was telling them, you need to own up to it. It is nice to have Gallup-McKinley School here, or the schools here, and also the Gallup-UNM here, because at least some Native students have a chance. And you see that. And so it's a start for them. But I think we need to open up their vision to where they could do more. And then we need to train these workers. And I think I was going to say, let's start a petition to remove Mr. Kuntz rather than writing a letter to the editor. I don't know if he's still here. But I admire his courage to bring those out. It makes us think about it. That it is somewhat true that some natives, workers, you know, the ethics, work ethics is not there. But that also goes to the teaching back to the parents and the grandparents. A long time ago, our work ethics was stellar. I remember my grandpa throwing me out of bed at 4 a.m. and to go look for the horses. And I was stumbling around without a flashlight, you know, and to try to find the horses, because by the time we have breakfast and ready to go, it's just a ride at daybreak, we have to move. And I remember that. Ntita. Only through your own work ethics will you advance yourself. That was the teaching. Today, what'd you guys invent for us? iPhone, Xbox, all that stuff, and kids have moved that way. And it's very hard to hold on to them. And then, of course, the alcohol. I think we have to also admit that our businesses and economic development activities are predatory in nature. And when you take the fight for the limited income, and you prey upon the inadequacies of humans, the shortcomings of humans, to make money. I mean, the loans, a lot of money goes there. I mean, alcohol. And so don't chew us out, don't chew our people out if you encourage that predatory practice. The little earned income tax credit that they get all ends up in a payday loan scheme. And in the end, there's less money or shoes or less money to buy erasers, school supplies, and required clothing for the kids, because it all ended up in a payday loan scheme or tax refund. And it's wrong. And I think, you know, we need some kind of movement against it and saying that we should not allow that in our communities. And so that let these families keep the money to better themselves, to better their children. Our children are behind because they can't buy the calculator, because they can't buy the laptop, or they can't pay for the Wi-Fi connection, because the money is going somewhere else. And so times they, you know, we have people saying that, well, that's America, that's capitalism. But there's got to be a different way to do these. So, and then the other thing I would venture to say is that I think, you know, we need to tell our representatives something similar to new market tax credit that we should allow in Native communities. So that, because it promotes partnerships. When you have businesses coming in, and since over here they work with new market tax credits and other kind of tax credit, why don't we do the same for starting businesses on native lands? And we have to recognize the native jurisdiction. You cannot have dual taxation. It actually adds up to being a triple taxation. That's why we have no Walmart. That's why we have no Home Depot. Because the very first thing that Walmart says is, how much tax are we going to pay? When it's double, triple, we're at a disadvantage. We can't get Walmart. We can talk about it all we want. I understand that the Walmart in Farmington, though, was originally supposed to be on the east side. And then a Walmart employee said, wait a minute here. All the dollar is coming in from the west side. Why don't we put the Walmart on the west side so we'll be the first one to get it? And so they built Walmart on the west side. And all the Navajo families come into Walmart in Farmington and spend their money there. Same thing with Gallup. Where is the economic activity happening? Towards the north side. Why? Because all the native population are driving in from there. And then there's no Indian center in Gallup. So there's no respect in a way for native people, native shoppers coming in. If we really want to be friends, and I've asked Gallup leaders this before, said, build an Indian center. Don't just put up signs that says you can't use the restroom. let's work together. Build an Indian center so we could give a place for native people, shoppers, when they come in, a place to rest before they head home. Gallup, when you look at the liquor districts, our area, McKinley County, has the highest number of liquor licenses per district. And we need to do away with that. It's the predatoriness of it. And what happens then afterwards is then we complain. And you see this on Gallup Independent. Gallup Independent loves showing dead Navajos on its front page. I've told them that before. Don't do that. Respect our culture and say that, you can just mention the name, we understand that, but don't show the pictures. We have a cultural thing about viewing dead bodies. But Gallup Independent likes to display it on its front page. Heck with Delegate Soce's request. It sells paper. And so this is what I think we all need to look at and reconcile with ourselves, our own behavior today, with the historical wrongdoings and the historical neglects and the historical discrimination against Native. That's why we are having the problem with the workforce, with our school performance, and with our economic development. And if we could just give the same opportunities to Native people, I think we will go a long way. That's not to say that all non-Navajos or Native are like that. I have a non-Navajo in-law, kindest person, kindest people, their in-laws. And so, but unfortunately, when you go higher up, where these things are made, these policies are made, it doesn't work that well, and it's not really favorable. But if we're Navajo, we were blessed with a settlement with the federal government, and we're trying to do economic development with it. But unfortunately, though, at times, and this is, I'm just being honest in my presentation, that we have frictions between tribes too. And, you know, and I've asked, when we went to Santa Fe for the renewal of Navajo Gaming Compact, we had over half of the Indian tribes in the state of New Mexico testified against Navajo. And when I was there, when Indian gaming first started, you know, Navajos never said no to anybody. But it's when you make money, sometimes it turns you into a greedy person. And so we had tribes, and it's like, let's figure out a way to do this. No, the whole I-40 is ours. You can't build another casino. And so we fight that day in, day out. So we have these intertribal and interregional fights. Even at our chapter level, Navajo chapters, I try to ask our Navajo chapters, work together, plan regionally. And I'll give you a good example. Down 491. You know, we made that four lane. And when I was in state senate, I had to threaten Governor Richardson on withholding my vote if he doesn't give us four lane. And so the state promised it and the state delivered. That's four lane now. But we've asked the chapters, you know, along that route, come together, work together for business development. It didn't happen. Yeah, I'm upset with the chapters. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because we have coached Navajo people something about land users' consent and this nonsense that I am not going to give you my land. It's not your land. Well, I graze my sheep there. You don't have a sheep. Well, it's still mine. I have a paper. See, internally, we fight over that for economic development. And I don't encourage you, but you'll see activists and Navajo people drawing horns on me. Because I called them out on this and say, you know, let's be honest with our conversation. And, you know, let's do it differently. And that's why the reason why, and I'll give you another story. Crown Point Hospital, the Eastern Health Board met there. I went over there and I got on my knees. And it said, just give us 3 acres back, pretty please, so we could build a C-store on 371. All the traffic is on 371, truck traffic and other traffic, so we could build a C-store there, partake in this economic development tool. Then, I think it was Thanksgiving, they fed me. And they said, now that you've been fed, Shiaj, don't ask again. And then later I did ask again, but through somebody else's legislation. And I voted for it. And I just said, let's just take it. That is the ultimate goal, is to do economic development, and let's just take it. The tribe has the authority to do that. And so we did. So I was in Flagstaff, fighting for Pueblo Pintada Health Clinic, and at an IHS meeting. And the Eastern Health Boards were there. And so, and then, I'm to this day, I still can't figure this out. The Western Agency representatives nominated me to help be on the budget formulation team. And the Eastern Board, where I'm from, all voted against me. And I said, what is wrong with this picture? So I went up to them and said, why'd you guys vote no? Well, you took away our land. But in the end, though, we're still fighting for Pueblo Pintada Health Clinic, and it's hundreds of jobs again. but we do have water out there. I think, you know, let's. I like to ask that, you know, let's study these historical nuances. And where there is a disadvantage to native population, you know, ask our representatives to put that to the side. We need to give them water too, because you need water for development. That's why Gallup fought for water. And you had a good representative in the name of Pete Domenici that said, you know, give Gallup water. And so, I thank Gallup UNM for, and then I think Melissa was pestering me to show up. And so, thank you for inviting me. But I do like to share my views and talk about it and bring these out. I've always said I don't hate anybody. You know, and I'm always trying to look for some kind of solution. Even though, that's why when he asked you, you know, how many you know, I think one of them said, Mr. Sosi, you went to Wingate High School. Save Wingate. How dare you? And then there was another dirty laundry pitcher in front of the council chamber that said, Speaker Bates and Delegate Sosi are the dirtiest people or whatever. You know, but we didn't have freedom of speech in our Navajo teaching. And I never talked back to my auntie, my uncle, my grandpas, and my grandmas. And our state schools told them, you can say whatever you want. And so our kids are coming home and say, damn it, grandma! Damn it, grandpa! And, you know, and this is where I think we need to recognize each other's societal norms. And so that, you know, we teach accordingly. And we have to respect those societal norms because it's really changing our kids. And I don't know if it's too late, but our kids have really changed. And it's hard. It's a lot of work to turn them back around to our cultural teachings. And so we need to figure out a way. Thank you very much. Yeah.
We can carry good discussion after when we get the panels going here. Yeah, let's do it then. Yeah, don't run off again.
My legislation is still.
You want to? You want to go ahead and? If you're really going.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Water. I mean, that's. I think water.
Yeah.
We're going to try to do a project, right, Sylvia? Yeah. And if I had you, basically ethnographic rescue to look at. What were people doing 15 years ago when there was water there, and now the water is gone?
At Tohatchee.
At Tohatchee. You know, the lake that used to be there is now gone. And then the question becomes is there a way to pull water off and bank it in for dry land agriculture? There's 1,000 acres out there that can be very useful to grow traditional foods and things that we're running out of, for example, just corn itself, for people to use, and as a counter to issues of diabetes. So we're going to do a study out there with our environmental scientists, anthropologists at the Tohatchee chapter, on what people used to do with water 15, 20 years ago, and then where's the water now? And then who do we go to, the hydrologist, to make a plea? And when the water line comes down, can we do a draw off and then use that for dry land drip irrigation? So maybe you can help us with that.
I think so. But you can't do water banking. We proposed water banking to the state of New Mexico when we were settling our water rights. And the state said no. You Navajo Nation cannot do water banking.
Who are these people in the state saying no?
The state senators, the state representatives, and the governor.
Or from Santa Fe.
Mainly down south. And so in the end, there had to be a compromise. We need the settlement. We couldn't let it. And so Navajo Nation, in a way, was forced to accept it without the water marketing. Arizona, we're still fighting. It's a big battle. And so, but Utah, we have a Utah water settlement that we're trying to get through Congress. That allows water marketing. So in terms of agriculture use, you have to almost use it at the same time it's coming in. You can use it. And I think you can enter into a partnership with Navajo and then the chapter to, yes, to use it. And so we were thinking this, along the same line with the Little Colorado River in Arizona, from Winslow towards the other. And said, let's just do farming on there. But there's a little stream, but there's a lot of water underneath it. And so let's just pump it out and use it for farming. And who are we fighting with now? Navajo squatters that moved onto the site and said, I don't want to move. And said, we got to use this. And we'll build you a nice, beautiful home. If you could just move half a mile. Well, I want money too. So, but that was the plan. We're looking. We've asked NAPI to help us with what we call NAPI 2 in Arizona 2. We really want to do that. Community farming.
Yes.
All that stuff. And yes, that where we want to do that stuff. Thank you.
I wanted to support one of the things that you were talking about. As a Belgana moving out here.
A good Belgana.
We hope. We try. I moved here from the east. Totally steep in Anglo-culture. Not that I didn't have awareness of the tensions and the history and some of the specific knowledge, but I came with that as my foundation. I came as a cartographer. But we don't call them cartographers anymore. We call them geospatial information systems specialists. And that's who I was. And the job I came out here to get was with, if you promise not to hurt me, the BIA. So I worked for the BIA for 12 years. Well, anyhow, early on when I was asked to clean up the maps that were on file, I got to those areas that you talked about. I got to, it's based on topographic lines around Lake Powell. I looked at that, and my first thought was, who the hell was doing the negotiating for the Navajo Nation to allow that to happen? Because it's totally unfamiliar anywhere else in the country. It is following the midstream channel, usually. I looked at that. That was my feeling. I think you might also want to look up at around Recapture Creek. There are some anomalies up around Recapture Creek that you might find interesting.
Thank you. It was George Velasquez. I've been wanting to look into how much money he made off Navajo. And I do say things to where it probably makes him turn in his grave. You know, and I call him names now. You know, and it was him. At the same time, though, I tell my leaders, you know, you should have done better. You should have done better. And so, you know, ask for the middle of the river. We have a fight going on the gold mine spill. And, yeah, and I think that'll bring that issue up, that where is Navajo water? And to me, it's the middle of the river. And so...
But you were right. By putting those lines around Lake Powell the way they did,
yeah,
the Navajo Nation from even having a bait and tackle shop.
Yeah, we can't touch the water.
Right.
We just can't. And that's economic development. I've been on the lake at Lake Powell. You know, tremendous market. Can't touch it. And hopefully in my lifetime we will correct that mistake. Mr. Teller, and then over here.
The subject is taboo, but there was mention of it. What are the barriers or perhaps the limitations maybe the advantages or disadvantages of the legalization of alcohol on the Navajo reservation.
One time, Delegate Jonathan Nez, who's the vice president now, proposed, I thought, that something that was good. Why don't we put the legalization of alcohol on Navajo Nation to the Navajo people? If they vote yes, fine. You know, then that doesn't mean that we're going to have a liquor on every mesa. You know, we'll control it, we'll tax the heck out of it, and use it for social consequences of alcohol. And then Speaker Nays ruled it out of order. And we fought that, you know, we fought that determination. I think when it comes to, I have to admit that I'm not brave, that when it comes to liquor issue, in a way it is, quote, a political death sentence for you to support it and vote for it. So I run from it. You know, and it's just that, you know, but I think with the generation changing and the need to do economic development, and we don't deny it that people with the most money are non-Navajos that eat at these restaurants. And what do they want to eat with their dinner? A glass of wine. And so I think the new generation coming in will change it. But just, I think this currently, just based on the problems we have had with alcohol, that people in the chapter communities, especially elders, don't want it. And so when people like me, sometimes, you know, speak about it, then they tongue lash me when I get back to the chapter. So I run from it. But I think it's that. But I think it's going to change, and I think it'll change very soon. I think the young generation sees that, you know, non-Navajos or non-Indians would like to have a glass of wine with their dinner, and it's part of economic development. I think that's coming.
Senator Soucy, or Council Delegate Soucy, coming again. I just wanted to say a couple things on behalf of the young Navajo people. There's always a conception that they're misbehaved, not well-behaved enough, or weren't taught properly. But in my capacity and just being in the community, a lot of the younger Navajo natives are dealing with parents that are already traumatized through the boarding school experience, are dealing with addictions, are getting crushed with the economic, you know, where they're not economically successful in this system. But then these young kids are going through the school system, know how to work with the technology, know how to navigate things. So not only are they teaching their parents, but in most cases they're also parents to their parents and their siblings. And so that's a lot of pressure on them, which is when they start cracking and then gravitating towards alcohol and drug abuse, and they reach out, but we don't have these kind of services to meet their needs when they need it. And I keep advocating counseling centers. This concept of, you know, young Navajos not working hard enough or not following the norm. The issue is that I think a lot of them are talented and actually more productive in a more limited time. So the way that they view life is a little bit different as opposed to working 8 hours a day. It's more like, can I get 8 hours of work completed in 4 hours? With their skills and knowledge, they can do that. We're just not reaching that access point. Another thing that I want to ask you was, what is your opinion on the land buyback program? And then one of the resistance that I see to that is the concept of lack of property rights. And it keeps going back to the concept of, oh, well, the Interior says that they are our trustees. They watch the world. So in a way, the Navajo tribe doesn't even have property or the title deed to that. Yet there are other countries like Palestine, for instance, who doesn't have that, but they have an underground network system where they have paper covering the land, ownership of the land where they can switch and trade it. Why hasn't that concept been explored? When I've hosted workshops, career fairs, events, I've invited you. You've attended, which is greatly appreciated. But I've also reached out to different Navajo Nation departments, different Navajo Nation industries. I've called division heads. I've called these people. I don't get any response. And this whole past year, not a single one of those people have showed up for any of those departments. The students that are here, 70% are Navajo or mostly Native. So I'm trying to help get from that skill into an employment sector. But it seems like there's so much resistance. So how do we skip that bridge and move forward and develop a stronger partnership? Where is there accountability? That's kind of what I'm getting at.
This is why I run from young Navajo people. They ask tough questions. that sometimes makes you reflect on all the mishaps you've been through. If I do this every once in a while, you drive through Gallup, especially these cheaper motels, and you'll see Indian families, mostly Navajo families, living there. And what is happening is that they're being introduced not to Navajo culture or Navajo teaching, but through the hardship of life without Navajo teaching. And then some easy way to make money, selling meth and doing other crazy things, where kids get in trouble. And you see young ones sticking their head out at the door because they're barely scraping money together to live their family. And it's also our fault as a Navajo Nation in trying to figure out the housing solution. And you've read about this where HUD is now wanting $96 million back because our housing agency is doing some crazy things with the money. And so hopefully we would try to change that. But, what I call the vicious cycle, and it is there. And so it's just a matter of, in terms of their behavior, coming together and figuring out, the correction center over here too. The fight over authority. And rather than figuring out a solution, if you get these people to sit down, they'll figure it out. But, it's trying to push each other around over jurisdiction and over authority. That, it has affected the recovery center here. And so on the land buyback, I support land buyback. The reason why is, one is it's voluntary. A long time ago, there was a law that was made by the federal government and kind of like doing what I said, let's just take it. And that was the escheatment. Then it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court and they said that was unconstitutional taking. So they zapped that one. And then this land buyback resulted out of the Cobell lawsuit. And it is better in the sense that now they're compensating Indian allottees and it's voluntary. And I've been telling Navajo allottees that if you want to keep ownership of a piece of land that's 0.00001%, it's okay. But how are you going to use it? It's up to you. My recommendation is to sell it. Make some money off of it. But this time, the structure was worked out to where it doesn't go back into public domain or to the U.S. government or the state government. It goes to the Navajo Nation in the interest. So in the end, the Navajo Nation will keep jurisdiction over that allotment. And it's not like the Yakima problem, where, when they opened that up, it all went, almost all of it went to non-Indians. This is different, that it remains in the control of Navajo Nation and Navajo people. The concern was Navajo people already living on the allotment, and of all things, the U.S. government was suspicious of Navajo Nation throwing off these residential lease and chasing Navajos out. And I try to assure them that we've never chased any Navajo off their home site lease. We're not going to do that. But my good smile wasn't good enough. Is that we don't believe you. We want you to pass some kind of law assuring the U.S. government that you're not going to bump off these people. So I thought, okay, we'll do it. So we did. And so, but the last I checked about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, $102 million was allocated for Navajo Nation in the land buyback program. And of that, I think $38 million has been expended. So we're at almost 38%. And I think other tribes, when they have done this across, I think what the average is over 40%. I have a feeling that Navajo Nation is going to go to 50% or even more. And people are selling their interests. And it's the fractionation problem. To talk about economic development, my experience at Casimiro Lake Chapter, working with the county, we're trying to build a pavement. There's an allotment there at the intersection. And it's got over 400 names. And I said, let's just go around it. I don't want to deal with it. Well, which one way do you want to go? So let's go west. There's an arroyo there. Let's go right. There's an arroyo there. And so we ended up we started that about 4 or 5 years ago, and we're still trying to collect names. And the thing about it is, with all this land buyback and all this education of Navajo Latis now, they want money. They want money, and they want us to pay them for the right-of-way. And so then, on the other hand, these same people come over here and say, you haven't built me a road yet. And then over here, that same Lati goes, I want money. And you know, the chapter doesn't have that much resource to pay for the right-of-way. And it's a problem, and we're still working on it. And those are the issues that I think on fractionation, if the Navajo Nation has a higher interest, I believe the economic development will go faster. Then you have Navajo assuming maybe over 50% of the ownership of an allotment. Then you just need Navajo Nation signature. So, but I understand the property rights and all of that. But you know, when my grandma, when they were giving out allotments, my grandma didn't get an allotment. Her view was that not Mother Nature or Mother Earth was not meant to be owned. That was her view. No property rights. That was her view. And so she never got an allotment. But my grandpa got an allotment in Seven Lakes area where all the oil is at. And then unbeknownst to him, they took the top part and stuck it on the side of a mesa where it's valueless. It doesn't have value. And that's how my family was treated too. And so my grandpa says, I don't know why they took my allotment and put it on the side of a mesa where you can't even build a house. But that's what they used to do. And, you know, I would encourage all of you to read about the history and the historical wrongs and be a good-minded citizen of McKinley County and Gallup and help us and stand with us to correct these wrongs so that we could have a better economic development and workforce development. But thank you, and I know I didn't answer two of your tough questions, but they're too tough. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon, for that was quite an eye-opener. Our main intention this afternoon's session was to, I guess you could call it befriending the Navajo Nation president as well as Mr. Sosi, who's very vocal in the council, and to make him aware of some of our problems that are maybe the unique's not the right word, but we similar common ground problems that we have here at the institution, and we'd like to request for their help. We need help here in various areas. And also, I have a habit, I keep saying Senator Soce. I live in Tohatchee, and my neighbors are the two gentlemen that are sitting there, and they were talking about trying to do economic development. And please don't give up on us. Well, there's some of us that still feel that we have a pretty good shot of economic development. We're in partnership with UNM Gallup, and we feel that we're close enough to all of these infrastructures to take advantage of it and have a piece of that big pie that's available. So, there's chapters that are nearby, and so Eddie and Chabahon Zinolishin. So thank you very much. You really have to leave because we have a panel discussion now. We really appreciate it if you can. So let's take 15 minutes. Let's be back over here at 3:45.